What is the old new land? Where is the old new land? The old new land is not a question of what or why, but when. It is those modes within the natural universe that we think are dependent upon the properties of God himself, but are in fact dependent upon the godliness within us, the God whose essence is composed of our modes and whose modes compose our essence. The old new land is that momentary disappearance of the illusion that divides the mind from the body, when thought becomes action and action becomes thought, when the senses of the body and the reason of the mind melds into divine intuition, and the disappearance of the illusions gives way to an entirely different illusion, freedom, which is in fact merely a moment in time which we fulfill the will of God more clearly than we ever did before and ever will again. The old new land is that moment when our will to life transfigures. Excuse me, Carla? Yes, Rabbi Swamley. It's all right, I interrupt you. I mean, whether it is or it isn't. It is or isn't what? I mean, you've interrupted me. So it's bad I interrupt you. At this point, what's the difference? I just want to know it's bad I interrupt you. Why don't you just tell me what you wanted to say? If it's bad I interrupt you, I won't interrupt you more. But you've already interrupted me. So if it's bad I interrupt you, I know I shouldn't interrupt you more. Can you just tell me what you wanted to say so I can get back to this? Aha, so it's bad I interrupt you then. Well, the longer you interrupt me, the worse it is. Okay, you'll get back to that Spinoza crap. I had no idea you read Spinoza. Well, it's clear I've read a lot more of that crap than you have. Okay, seriously, what did you want to talk to me about? I wanted to ask you how you could harbin your father like that. What do you mean? The first podcast, the one character, he was clearly your father and you smeared drek all over him. Oh my God, that character is not my father, right? The character is not your father and Arafat was serious about their peace process. Are you kidding me? Are you serious? What's there to be serious? I just asked you a question. Rabbi, we're on the air. So you could just answer the question and you go back to doing this Narasha introduction. Have you even looked at the title page of the podcast? Should I? It says he's the fucking hero of the whole story. Okay, you don't have to swear. Really? I just wanted to know why you say bad things about your father. That shouldn't be on Chilul Hashem. The character is not my father. All right, don't get so bad. Go back and do that Sudre Spinoza thing. Thank you. The old new land is a different place for everyone. For some, the old new land is freedom. For some, the old new land is achievement. For some, the old new land is love. And for some, the old new land is justice and equality. At the end of this episode, we shall abandon for a few months the ignominious tales of A.C. Charlap to tell the tales of Clarissa Johansson, our first hero of the old new land. For Clarissa is very much a hero, an Eshet Chayil, a woman of stunning valor and bravery, with the strength and force of will to move the world, a composite of a dozen or more women of valor whom this narrator has had the great privilege and pleasure to know over his lifetime. Not biblically speaking, of course, God forbid he should ever have known them biblically, but whose great bravery and strength deserve far more than they've ever gotten and could ever get. We shall go back four generations through her family past and go three generations into her family future. We shall explore the seeds of generations that made her possible. We shall explore the generational seeds she made possible for the future. But like so many of these iron women of valor, she'll work and she'll work and she'll work and she'll wait and she'll wait and she'll wait. But we're always thrown out of the old new land.
Nasca et mos rotemo. Yeah. Thank you.
This writer, A.C. Charlap, begs your indulgence for the crude and coarse, the slow and stagnant, the gaudy and garish passages of a man in no hurry to tell his repugnant story than history is to tell us hers. And after hearing this tale, I'm sure you will wonder whether the characters A.C. Charlap introduces are mere avatars of the people he knows. The answer, my friends, is of course that they're close. There's a certain resemblance, but they're not the same. They are mere caricatures of the more complex human versions of themselves and much, much simpler exaggerations of the real people who populate this world here and not the world of the old new land to come. And therefore, as history ever does, he begs your patience. And now a glum lecture on the Second Iraq War of 2003 by Dr. Marvin Vitebsk, director of the Yitzhak Shamir Foundation on Security Studies and editor-in-chief of the Shamir Foundation's journal, The Middle East Defense Quarterly. He's also the Sheldon Adelson Senior Fellow in Media and Education Bias at the Jabotinsky Institute, the director of International Anti-Israel Propaganda Rapid Response at the Ben Sion Netanyahu Foundation for Global Research, second executive vice chairman of the Kahana Committee on the Present Danger, fourth vice director of the Jesse Helms and Phyllis Schlafly Coalition for the Democratic Minority, contributing editor to magazines like Commentary, The Weekly Standard, The National Review, New Criterion, Front Page Magazine, The New American, The American Spectator, The American Conservative, The American Standard, and former fellow of the American Enterprise Institute before hitting Richard Perle over the head with a 2x4. After getting an undergraduate degree in classics at the City College of New York, which he paid for by becoming a janitor at the Rand Corporation and then leaking documents to Maoist China, he then switched allegiances and got all charges dropped by producing visual film to Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara of hitting Zhu Enlai over the head with a 2x4. Marvin then received 2 doctoral degrees at the University of Chicago. His first doctoral thesis, entitled Democracy, the American Weakness, was supervised by Alan Bloom. His second doctoral thesis, entitled The Benefits of Mutually Assured Destruction, was supervised by Albert Wolfstetter. Both theses were published in abridged form as cover stories in Commentary magazine. While at the University of Chicago, Dr. Vitebsk briefly gained national eminence in a case for which he was prosecuted for assaulting another University of Chicago student with what was misreported as a 7x16. He assaulted this student because he advocated for peaceful resistance against capitalist oppression. The student's name was Bernard Sanders. After which he appeared in roundtable discussions on shows hosted by Mike Wallace, Edward R. Murrow, Keith McBee, David Brinkley, Walter Cronkite, and Dick Cavett. His period as a television personality ended, however, in 1978 when he hit the longtime AFL-CIO director George Meany on the air over the head with what was clearly a 2x4. He then served as distinguished congressional aide to Senator Scoop Jackson of Washington and briefly served as deputy chief of staff to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan until a fight with Moynihan's then chief of staff, Timothy Russert, ended with Dr. Vitebsk hitting Mr. Russert over the head with a plywood of indeterminate length. After the Iranian Revolution, he made the cover of Time magazine for having been the only man in CIA employ to hit both Ayatollah Khomeini and Saddam Hussein over the head. The implement with which he did so, however, is still classified. After the fall of communism, Dr. Vitebsk revealed himself, though some have disputed his account, to have been the covert CIA assassin of both the brief-tenured Soviet premiers Andropov and Chernenko, whose deaths the Soviets pretended were due to natural causes as a way of saving face in the international arena, and which enabled the rise of Mikhail Gorbachev and a new generation of Soviet leaders who believed in glasnost and perestroika. Once again, the implement with which he assassinated them is classified. Dr. Vitebsk now divides his time between Silver Spring and French Hill in East Jerusalem. We are pleased to have him here in this studio. Dr. Vitebsk.
Yes, I'm going to begin this lecture by objecting in the most strenuous possible terms to Mr. Charlap's reference to East Jerusalem, when in fact Jerusalem is the undisputed and undivided capital of an Israeli state whose borders go from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River and include the entirety of the provinces of Judea and Samaria, which billions of anti-Semites still refer to as the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I have been told that my subject today is the Iraq War. How does one begin to talk of something of such existential importance to mankind? The Iraq War was, in fact, the still unresolved and ticking time bomb, which is, in effect, holding the entire world hostage until we defeat it with unconditional victory. As my ex-friend Norman Podhoretz said, it is a prime battlefront upon which World War IV was waged, twice, in my opinion. The first being the Persian Gulf conflict, which is properly called Operation Desert Storm in 1991, and again in Operation Iraqi Freedom, which I will not dignify with the name that is generally used, and a third Iraqi conflict, which no doubt will soon rage again. You may notice that I say World War IV was raged, for there have been not two world wars, but four. The third was the Cold War, which the anti-Semitic media unfortunately sold the United States as a war which could be waged without demanding millions of casualties from the American public at large. This is World War III, and it is still ongoing. As a result, we are now in 2016 and have a communist China whose communism should, in fact, have been stopped by President Truman in 1948. We had dozens of perfectly decent atomic bombs at our disposal, and Stalin had just barely developed his. By my estimation, we could have dropped 3 dozen atomic bombs on the Chinese mainland, and Stalin's second strike capability was still such that he'd only have been able to retaliate by dropping 3 or 4. In fact, now that the Soviet Union is gone, the coming conflict with China, which is long overdue, should be referred to as World War V. But World War IV is the war against radical Islam. Perhaps I should refer to it as World War VI, because we seem to have already lost World War IV. Actually, I would call it World War IX, but we will not get into the other three world wars. What is crucial is that the crisis of Islam's infiltration into the West cannot be more grave. It happens because 41% of Muslim countries experience civil war, while only 27% of Christian countries experience it. Muslims have a 3.1 children birth rate per family, while Christians have a 2.7 children birth rate per family. There are, in fact, 140,000 Islamic refugees from Syria coming into Germany alone this year, and Germany rejected only two-thirds of their applicants for asylum. Once in Germany, the Muslims can take advantage of the handouts offered by the social welfare state. Muslims already make up 5.8% of the German population and 7.5% of the French population. By halfway through the millennium, they may constitute a majority of Europe's population. Anti-Semitic Western liberals like to explain away such things with condescending relativism, treating minorities like children and their differences as something to be celebrated and assimilated into our culture, whereas we are clearly the bastions of liberalism and tolerance, and therefore they must be forced to assimilate and adapt to our culture. I have come up with a 3-point plan to strengthen liberal resolve. You can find elaboration upon it in a book I entitled Spine, How to Close the Liberal Soul. 1. Anti-Semitic and European liberals must be made to uphold the social order. I have infinite faith that the disasters coming to cosmopolitan cities like New York and London and Paris will strengthen liberal resolve. I worry, however, that the far greater death tolls from the political restrictions of a president like Donald Trump will distract liberals from Islam, the true threat in their midst. 2. Government must be shrunk and an ethic of personal responsibility must be facilitated and encouraged to take its place. And I've outlined a proposal for a government department of personal responsibility on the cabinet level that will have offices in every town of America. My anti-Semitic grandson, who protests at rallies to stop Israeli occupation, tells me that this is a contradiction in terms, but he would. 3. Anti-Semitic liberals must stop the crude patronization of minorities by insisting that their problems have reasons. Liberals like my third anti-Semitic ex-wife are, in fact, the true racists, whose programs merely benefit and enrich the lives of impoverished minorities when what they should be doing is forcing minorities to conform to the standards of how to behave that the country sets for them. This, of course, necessitates a second plan, which is 6 points long. You can find an elaboration for this in my book, Submit, Destroying Democracy to Rebuild It. 1. Because of the intolerant tolerance of liberals, America is in the direst of crises. Confidence in its authorities is undermined, and because of that, any talk of reforming our institutions must take a back seat to upholding them. Authority must be reestablished. While I may disagree with particular policies of the Trump administration, particularly in its use of anti-Semitic propaganda, I'm in fact overjoyed that a president has finally come along who will use the office of the presidency to its fullest capacity, particularly against the coming demographic threat from Islam. American Muslims are now more than 1% of American residents, and by 2150, might constitute a full 2.5% of the American population. It would be a disaster for national security. We would have to register every Muslim in this country and follow all of their whereabouts, though this would actually be good practice for World War XII. 2. Only a morally corrupt society questions authority. What ails the United States is not a decline of an economic system, but a decline of values. The individual in contemporary America has too many rights and therefore uses its rights to pursue happiness. Traditional means of enforcing authority, like religion and nationalism, have been completely eroded by the counterculture. Just last week, I was at a conference in Maine, and I went out to dinner with Abe Foxman and Marty Peretz. And while we were waiting for our lobster rolls, we all agreed that religion, particularly, was of paramount importance to enforcing societal norms. Without a God to tell us what to do, what is there to stop us from making our own choices? 3. God must drain the swamp of the counterculture, and we must be the gods. The biggest mistake this country ever made was the formation of the middle class, and the middle class is a spoiled class of children. Every subsection of the middle class is concerned with its own subsection of issues. There are racial and sexual and gender and anti-Semitic identities and the rights that are due them rather than their responsibilities to this country. A much smaller and more respectable middle class will divert the attention of people back to the issues that truly matter, like the poverty to which the Trump administration will soon acquaint them. 4. We must lower people's expectations of what government and life can do. The more they expect, the more they will protest, and protesting is the first and greatest sign of a decadent and anti-Semitic society that undermines confidence in its institutional authority. Institutional authority exists to be revered, not to be used. A government that doesn't do anything can never be criticized. 5. An intellectual is not an expert, and a government should never be administered by experts on their subjects, particularly by intellectual experts whose knowledge of the subject is suspect in its select and subjective anti-Semitism. What is needed is government by a pliable head of state of sub-average intelligence, who can then be molded by a philosophical elite of intellectuals with sufficient morals. 6. In order to create this philosophical elite, we must rid ourselves of the pestilence of these anti-Semitic, fascist, authoritarian, and totalitarian university professors, who corrupt even our best minds with radical anti-Semitic theories of social change. And we must do so by firing them all immediately without so much as a hearing about their competence. They have, furthermore, banished conservatives like me and most of my enemies from campus life. And conservative intellectuals, unfortunately, have to content themselves with jobs in think tanks, corporate consultancies at 3 times the salary of traditional academics, articles for conservative magazines underwritten by spectacular endowments, paid international vacations to meet with right-wing leaders around the world, and astronomical speaking fees at conservative retreats. We conservative thinkers truly live in a tragic state of affairs. And the way to drain this liberal countercultural swamp can be found in 3 points elaborated in my book, Filth, Why the Middle Class Must Die. 1. The reason that being that once the anti-Semitic middle class is fully again part of the working class, their concerns will be no different from the working class. I am heartened to see that Donald Trump, for all his other superficialities, seems to agree with me about the necessity of destroying the middle class. And even if I take issue with certain statements of his aide, Steve Bannon, I must say that I find him to be a very sympathetic person on the whole, and not at all anti-Semitic. 2. Individual merit is the most precious thing in the world. Therefore, inherited wealth must be maintained at all costs. It would be a shame if wealthy mediocrities would stop running this country because the anti-Semitic leaders of this country would be too intelligent to be molded by the virtuousness of the philosophical elite. 3. While the government should be perfectly docile in its management of domestic affairs, it must root out moral corruption abroad, lest its corruption contaminate us. The main purpose of government is to destroy monsters abroad, because if we do not, the moral swamp will become ours, and then we have to rid ourselves of the anti-Semitic middle class and their anti-Semitic vices all over again. 4. In addition to Republican politicians of inherited privilege, the ranks of these philosophical elites must consist of traditional Democratic liberal hawks, as the Democratic Party was constituted from the time of Franklin Roosevelt to Hubert Humphrey, and traditional union leaders like Leon Bates, George Meany, Walter Reuther, and Philip Randolph, all 4 of whom I've stabbed in bar fights. All this is just a prelude to talking about the Iraq War of 2003, which I still believe is the most important battlefront in World War IV, or in actuality, World War IX. As I said before, there are 3 other wars I have not yet even spoken of. Dr. Potemsk, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we really have to die, you anti-Semitic filth!
On Wall Street, they have the 4-hour lunch. In Spain, they have the 10 p.m. dinner. In Washington, we have happy hour. 4 to 7, 5 days a week, establishments that are otherwise only available to lobbyists and the congressmen they wine and dine with a leisurely New York-style lunch, or what should be a nightcap but usually signals that the real festivities are just beginning. How can it possibly be a bribe if it's in the form of a couple martinis and a steak at the Capitol Grill, or a fillet of swordfish at Cafe Milano, or a burger at the Palm, or even just an apple pie at Blue Duck, or those amazing jellied candies that come with the bill at Equinox? But from 4 to 7 p.m., these places fit to feed masters of the universe keep their prices just barely low enough that the intern class of Washington, D.C. can afford to feel like men of power and leisure, and then return home after a year or summer in the capital of the world without a cent to pay off their student loans. In a capital city where everybody passes responsibility down, the interns are the people that really run the greatest country on earth, and they know it. You see it in the swagger of their every step, The security of youth allied to the feeling that they and they alone are getting away with making decisions that no 22-year-old is supposed to make. But thanks to the enormity of their intellect, their toughness, their beastly competence, the halo of future eminence that shines upon them, they all know they're being groomed for the higher things. Surely each one of them is the only person in D.C. of their age asked to submit a position paper or take minutes for a half-hour meeting between a congressman and a cabinet secretary, or be the one to sit behind the congressman at a committee meeting just because an aide is stuck in traffic. All of their friends are just lying to keep up, and sometimes they are too. It is impossible for a young person of ambition and talent not to be bowled over by Washington. A city of truly classical habitus, built to look like London, which was built to look like Berlin, which was built to look like Paris, which was built to look like Constantinople, which was built to look like Rome, which was built to look like Athens, which was built to look like Alexandria. And as these would-be pharaohs look upon the central node of their future domain, the Washington Wall, with its seemingly endless walkways and lawns and ponds and order, 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 it is impossible to fathom the chaos of the lands they've resolved to govern. It is inconceivable that the perfect kingdom of perfect harmony and perfect order, which would exist with but a little nudge, that they alone have the unique magnetism to angle with the exact right direction and pressure, might not happen from their unique ministrations. All they have to do is prove themselves worthy of their divinely mandated dominion. Though they make starvation wages at best, though they subsist on a combination of money from their summer jobs in high school and parents' help, which they never tell their friends about. Though they operate on meals of caffeine every day to tighten themselves up and alcohol every night to loosen themselves down. Though their parents complain that they never call or write unless things are truly dire. Nevertheless, all they must do in D.C. is prove themselves worthy to be noticed, to be retained, to be promoted, to be feted, so as to achieve this most important goal for this most important career in this most important city, in this most important country, for its soon-to-be most important person. So important must they be, will they be, are they, that they will drunkenly return to their offices at 10 or 11 p.m. while their nonprofit roommates are getting ready for bed. They continue their work until 2 or 3 in the morning, drafting emails and writing handwritten letters to constituents, licking the envelopes and postage stamps, or other things, taking an hour and a half break to stay up on the latest news and commentary in The Atlantic or The National Review or The Nation, falling asleep mid-article and awakening just long enough to finish and return to work by making sure the statistics are exactly right in the morning briefing, that there are the exact right number of ordered balloons and lemonade gallons and wheels of cheese and boxes of crackers for the next week's town hall back home, composing a list of 50 different slogans to sell to the latest shipments of jobs overseas as being part of the benefit to their constituents, and a dozen drafts of proposals for position papers that they could write which might interest the big boss or his boss or even someone over on Pennsylvania Avenue. After they've done all this, they hail one of the hundreds of cabs which just happened to be around Capitol Hill in the middle of the night, so they can return to their Arlington apartments for their blissful 2.5 hours of sleep, procured at an awesome expense no 22-year-old should afford. But for those 3 hours between 4 and 7, these secret pharaohs rule their kingdom in the open. Blonde skin turns, the two smart daddy's girls of underemployed Youngstown auto workers who look to bag themselves a future congressman with perfect hair and a dark suit with no dandruff on it, always on the lookout for the prize one who will make them into a reincarnated Jackie Kennedy, but willing to settle for a Dick Nixon in the ladies' room on an ordinary Tuesday evening. Gangly boys with too much mousse in their hair from Pensacola who got piled on by the football team at home, but in Washington are worshipped like Apollos, inhaled, imbibed, drank, drained, sipped, and supped upon by girls with white blouses and skirts so tight that no man in Washington knows how to get them off. Still ganglier boys from San Diego who realize who they are after a few drinks with the square-jawed interns from Jackson, whereupon the two decide to have a smoke behind the dumpster, but those healthy boys from Mississippi still don't know who they are and probably never will. The Jewish girls from Westchester County who are working at a nonprofit and want to get to know themselves better, whereupon they meet those 30-ish women from the Pacific Northwest working on the other side of the office with the short hair and the broad shoulders who know all the good dive bars in Mount Pleasant and Petworth and are such good listeners. The conversation continues back at their apartments where the woman from Seattle fixed the girls' freezers. But the girl from New Rochelle didn't mean to make them fall in love, and they're sorry if they hurt you. The bistro bar where A.C. Charlap was waiting for his friend was Citroen Cafe, which literally skirts the very line where Washington meets Maryland. 10 feet from the door and you are no longer in Capital City, but just another unprepossessing state among 50, best known for its crabs and crime.
Excuse me, Charlap? What? Are you always so mad when I interrupt you? Didn't we just go through this? You don't have to be so mad all the time. I haven't been mad until you keep making me mad. Also, it's my fault you're always mad all the time. It's beginning to look like that. No wonder Dr. Vitebsk hit you in the head with that wood thing. Thanks, Rabbi. I just interrupt to say that you're bleeding. Yes, Rabbi, I'm well aware of that. You want I should get you a paper towel? Yes, Rabbi, that would be lovely. All right, I'll get you the paper towel. You need some Band-Aids, too? Sure. Rubbing alcohol? Why not? You want I should get you a doctor and a lawyer? No, I don't think that's necessary. You want I should get you the Ganze Welt for the whole Machiah? No, Rabbi, I don't. Because you're asking me to do everything. What? You told me I'm just here to read the social media, and now you want me to get all the whole first aid kit. I didn't know I have to do a Ganze Megillah. All right, if it's too much trouble, I'll get the paper towel myself. No, I get the towel. It's just what? You want to thank you? Is it so much? Thanking you? Never. You sound like you don't mean that. Oh, my God. But! Never mind, I'll get it myself. Okay, get the paper towel yourself. I do the social media now. We don't even have time to do the social media now. I'll have you do it later. Okay, so you want me to get the paper towel? If it's not too much trouble. No, it's not too much trouble. Okay, so get the paper towel. What's too much trouble is you have me get here so early and then you don't want me to read the social media. Never mind, I'll get the towel myself. Go ahead and read the social media. Oi, Hillel, you could have stayed home today and watched the best film, but no, Chalap needs you to read the social media. Are you reading the social media? I thought you don't want me to read it. Oh my God. What? Oh my God. You don't want me to read the social media? I don't read the social media. Never mind. I'll go back to the story now. Aha! You go back to the story and I not read the social media. As a mensch, Charlap is. You'll read it in a little bit.
AC was supposed to meet Justin Maddox, that friend of his who was on his way to seminary back in 2001, but by 2008 was seemingly determined to stoop his way through Washington. AC strongly suspected that Justin was on the prowl for skin turns, or at the very least, in the bedroom of some bespectacled nonprofit social justice warrior he'd just looked up online. Justin Maddox was a blonde English Catholic, the ultimate goy, from the one state in America where Catholics have always been state royalty. Justin was a fellow Baltimorean who apparently went to the same summer camp as AC when they were kids, but they had no memory of each other. Justin's mother's family was pure working-class Irish, in Pittsburgh from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th. But his father's family was over here by 1700, with plenty of names among his family line made illustrious by local history from their 1633 passage to Queen Henrietta Maria's land aboard the Ark and the Dove with Leonard Calvert, younger brother to Second Lord Baltimore and first proprietary governor of the North American colony of Marysland. Within 2 days of moving into the dorms, Justin was already dating Samantha Mueller, a German Catholic blonde from Ohio whose virginity was apparently taken when she took his the first night of their relationship. She was, of course, spending 20 hours a week on the Hill at skin turning for her Republican congressman. There is no intimacy quite like the pressure cooker intimacy of college freshmen, packed like sardines into close quarters with others about whose true personal nature they have no idea. It takes at least 6 months of college to cull the real friendships from the false ones that end with explosive feuds rife with accusations of betrayal and deception from people who've been your best friends for 3 weeks, only 2 days after both of you vomited half a bottle of cheap vodka and held each other's heads over the toilet. From such humble beginnings can come the strongest lifelong friendships, but 80% of the time, the vomit is a symbol for the trouble that ensues. Unlike Justin, AC clearly had ample time for socializing, and during those socializing hours, AC managed to alienate virtually everyone with whom he came into contact to what was his tortured despondence at the time. He talked every day to his mother about dropping out of college, or at least transferring somewhere. but he was too depressed not to fail freshman philosophy, so the only option he could get transferred to was a 2-year community school. The drinking made him put on weight, and he found himself binge eating with no father to tear the food away from him. Desperate for acceptance, he picked up smoking in the hope that the camaraderie of smokers would take him in as one of their own. A.C. Chollop had always looked quite a bit older than his years, but by the time he was a college sophomore, the double chin and the lines on his face marked him as being well over 30. There was just something too weird about the guy to make anything but a horrendous 1st, 5th, 9th, 13th impression. But on the 18th or so impression, his honest directness, his pedantry, his worldly and world-weary hyper-articulation, his cruel jokes at the expense of everyone, particularly himself, his bizarre mixture of high seriousness with the crudest vulgarities became something of a comfort to these other kids. These earnest blonde Midwesterners who think he doesn't care enough, these tri-state Guidos who think he cares too much, these non-Yiddish-speaking slackers from Monmouth County who think he tries too hard, these Asian overachievers from the Bay Area who think he doesn't try hard enough, these cruelly entitled white kids from South Carolina who think he's a pushover, these dutiful kids from the white state of New Hampshire who think he's cruel, these black kids from Little Rock who think he's entitled, these Cuban kids from Miami who think he's always making fun of their privilege. In a city where everybody tries to be as generic as possible, here was someone memorable, and when all had acclimated to one another, he was finally admitted to his place among the nations. Soon he was known as a corpulently merry sort whose Falstaffian jollity delighted all. Even if this mirthful young man whose despondence had aged him could come down unpredictably on people with a rage whose vehemence was truly comic in his proportions, it was so over the top that how could it possibly be threatening? It seemed simply part of his gusto, his larger-than-lifeness, his ability to impress every moment in his presence as an event. They'd make fun of him for his rages, provoke him to them, give him reason to fight back, because never was he more eloquent than in the fever pitch of his wrath, when he'd land brutal bullseyes on the object of his outrage with a film of truth around them so uncomfortable that the provocateur couldn't even admit to being mad, because everybody would quote the quip about them for months thereafter. Perhaps it was not because he was particularly clever, but because he had no compunctions about saying aloud the things people keep to themselves. The Jewish kid from Great Neck with Gay Shtiklach, who was known as Harvey Firestein for the rest of college. When fighting about politics with a girl who interned for a senator from Alaska, he told her she wouldn't know a historical date if she were going down on him. The girl from St. Louis County who had Disney bedsheets was told she needed a better cover if she wanted to keep slutting it up. The wiry Rotsy kid from Norfolk with a military crew cut was asked if he ever found a 6-foot vagina on shore leave. The 17-year-old from Monterey, whose voice hadn't changed yet but made fun of AC's weight, was told where he could find a store in San Francisco that sells pubic Rogaine. The Charleston boy who pledged a frat in his first semester was told that if he wanted to rape girls so badly, he could get some chloroform from the janitorial closet. The modest girl studying international affairs from Beirut was told there are cheaper ways to get a bomb underneath her chador. All these and many more were the insults that first made him an outcast, then a local celebrity, then practically an institution during this interregnum between the dual university reigns of political correctness. Though for none was the change in regard more so dramatic than with Justin, whom at first not only shunned AC, but poisoned everyone against him for his general slovenliness, his irritability, his unreliability, his insistence on confessing to the most personal demons. But Justin came around just as everyone else did, the entertainment value of his roommate becoming like an old shoe or a nightly Woody Allen routine before bed. As we said, during those months when AC felt hatred for Justin's contempt, AC had ample time for socializing on their dorm floor's lounge with whomever was there, and every member of their floor went through the same cycle of resentment at his bizarreness, followed by reconciliation with his eccentricities, followed by enjoyment of his bonhomie. But even during those final few months of freshman year, when AC was practically the social hub around which the entire dorm floor turned, Justin was a friendship apart, only spoken to for a few minutes in the morning and an hour before bed, which then became lunch, which AC and Justin and Sam made time for in the cafeteria with each other every weekday, while seemingly dozens of people would stop by their table to pay tribute to the court which AC held with such aplomb. But during those evening hours when the conscientious should be studying, AC would be extemporizing in the lounge while Justin and Sam made themselves scarce for 2 hours at a time, inevitably leaving a dirty sock on their door when Justin required the room and promising to do the same for AC whenever he required it. Justin's hips inevitably returned to the lounge a half hour before the rest of him. Toward the end of the year, during a take-home exam in a class they were both in, AC required some book from his room. Perhaps it was a book to cheat slightly, or perhaps it was simply one of the pencils he consistently forgot to carry with him to class. Seeing no choice in the matter, Charlap obdurately knocked 7 times on the door in the span of 3 minutes, knowing fully well what a breach of unspoken etiquette this was. Justin finally opened the door with bemused fury. What? In these days of May, when colleges around America save money by waiting until the last excusable day to turn the air conditioning on, the dorm rooms were a healthy 85 degrees at least. The room smelled shamefully of body odor and the windows were fully steamed. Sam was wearing nothing but a comforter, while Justin was wearing nothing on his exactly 6-foot frame but a pair of skin-tight leopard print pants. Never mind, I'll get it from somewhere else. AC left without explanation and found a reason to tell that story every day thereafter for the rest of college.
And now let's finally do some social media with Rabbi Swami. Finally. Well, since Harlap didn't like me doing the social media last time, we're going to do it all different now. Bella Russell of Mount Washington writes on the Twitter that Rabbi Swamley shouldn't work with A.C. Charlap. He's a very smart but difficult man who gives Rabbi Swamley a lot of trouble. What? That's what she said. Let me see that. No, you want me to say, you want I should read the social media, so I'm reading the social media. Uh-huh. Ellen Gerlitz from Randallstown writes that you're a who ruins every organization he is part of. Are you done? Well, it's what they say. Is it really? Hold on. We got another one. Shulamit Haas from Pickwick writes that she saw you coming to Beit Knesset a couple of weeks ago, and you were too late to see Rabbi Swamley read the Torah, and you weren't wearing a tie, and you were dressed like you were going to the beach. All right, that's it. We're going back to the story. It's my turn to read the social media. You're not reading the social media. I'm reading the social media you deserve. All right, this is ridiculous. We can talk about this later. Oh, you get to talk more, but we'll talk about this later. Yes, that's exactly what we're going to do. I have a story to tell. You've got a story to tell. What about my stories? You never even read them. What are you talking about? I write stories. Why can't I read mine? I didn't know you wrote stories. You never rest. All right, you need to calm down. I need to calm down. You're the one who's reading the stories. Nobody wants to hear my stories. All right, Rabbi, I'll read your stories. Oh, you say that. You say that, but you don't want to read them. What? You're only saying you want to read my stories. Yes, you're right, Rabbi. I don't really want to read your stories. I'm just saying I want to. You don't have to be so mad about it. What? Don't be so mad. We can talk about this later. All right.
Within a month of their relationship, Justin and Samantha were talking about marriage, but within 6, Justin desperately wanted out. The relationship ambled on for another year thereafter, as Samantha came to his parents' house for Easter. Justin went to her parents for Thanksgiving, and the two families went on a Christmas skiing vacation together in the Pennsylvania Appalachians. Their parents were already talking to them about the perils and advantages of home ownership and joint bank accounts. In mid-March 2003, less than a week before he was due at Sam's parents' house for Easter, Justin dropped the bombshell, seemingly without warning. AC knew how badly Justin wanted to break up with Sam, and advised him against it in the most strenuous possible terms every day for the first 6 months of their sophomore year. Indeed, AC made sure all their mutual friends knew too and demanded they similarly admonish Justin for such a foolish action. But having more sense than AC, they knew better than to let such a noxious stink bomb into public air. Sam was blindsided, emotionally sucker-punched, made aware of organs that were ripping that she was not even aware of. Her entire future cast down without a moment's notice to a pit out of which she could not climb. Walking out of Justin's dorm room, AC was the first person Sam saw after Justin robbed her of her future, the tears practically staining her face. AC wrongly thought Justin had nothing like the temerity to go through with something so drastic, so even he was shocked when Sam told him. Of course, AC knew about it and made no effort to conceal that he did, which made Sam still more angry and made AC the center of her displaced rage for not having warned her. Thereafter, AC and Samantha remained former friends from a distance who were cordial at best. Justin and Sam both pledged to Greek life, Justin to a fraternity which would reject AC a year later, and indulged engorgingly upon the newfound opportunities, advantages, and perks which come from the status of acceptance in the company of cool. Justin did so with joyful abandon, the game quickly becoming his all-consuming passion beyond that of any studies or interests. Master of the B-list, Charlap called him in more affectionate moments. Sarostitution client in moments of less. But what Justin did with aplomb, Sam seemed to do with agony. At every party hosted by mutuals, Sam seemed too drunk to walk. And on the nights she didn't vomit, or perhaps on the nights when she did, she would leave with fraternity brothers who seemed particularly knuckle-dragging, perhaps even known for it. Men not of her intelligence, not of her sophistication, not of her generosity. She deserved better. People were forgetting about that, and perhaps she forgot it herself.
Bei mir in Herzen sieht es wie ein Galizianer Borsch. Es schwindelt in die Augen, der Kopf wird als so viel. In mein linken Leben tanzen a Kadrill. Sie ist wie ein feige Lebensblieb. Sie ist doch mein blieber Lebensblieb. Ui, I like she. Sie's mein Glück, sie's mein Streben, und ihr gern ich doch nicht leben. In Herzen wurd jetzt allemal. Ihr Figur mit ihren Locken, I'll tell you people's neue Socken. I like she, oh ja, I like she, in der Tat. I like she. Sie ist mein Glück, sie ist mein Streben. Und ihr Kern ist doch nicht schlimm. In Herzen furchtet allemal. Ihre Fiesler, ihre Socken. I'll tell you people's neue Socken. I like she, boy, I like she in der Stoll. Leg ich mich nur schlafen, hol ich mich von mir. In mir dacht ich, als ich sie schien noch und leid mir. Ich fang sie an zu kischen, ich rief sie lieber Schatz. Ich hab mich untersehen, als ich kisch die schwarze Katze. Sei ihr voll im Wind, sei auf der Wacht. Weiß ich, liebe Freunde, noch nicht da. I like she. Geschehen sagt mir, sogar hoffen, kann ich sterben, kann ich schlafen. In Herzen wutschert allemal. Ich kick auf Schicksal, in auf Nyankes, nur sie helft, wie ein Teutenbeinches. I like she, oh ja, I like she in der Tat. I like she. Sie ist mein Glück, sie ist mein Streben. Und ihr kann ich doch nicht leben. In Herzen furchtet allemal. Ich such auch jeden, doch ich nimm es. Sie ist Geschmack wie ein Merlenzimmer. I like she, yeah, I like she in der Tat.
But since Justin had nowhere he wanted to go for Easter, his parents being furious at him for throwing his future away with Samantha, AC invited him to spend a Passover Seder with the Charlaps. There is no way to prepare the Ubagoy for the most Jewish of all Seders. The demanding insistence that you answer the most personal questions within 60 seconds of hello in the kitchen. The hour of bonhomie which turns on a dime into yelling recriminations while the youngest kid reads the four questions and back again to hilarity when it's time to make the bracha over the matzah. The fanatical debates about politics over dinner during which somebody's always evil or an idiot. While the Pesach dicker food makes its dehydrating salt assault upon your system. All the while, AC bucks tradition so as not to make his friend feel regret for being there, and pours a full glass of wine for himself and Justin whenever the Seder mandates a cup be drunk, an action which does not escape comment by Ovachet, which causes Abba and Olivchet to have a 10-minute shouting match in plain view of everyone at the table, who simply shrug as though this is part of the religious rite. When Justin and AC met, it was established within a few moments that Charlap was an agitating firebrand socialist, wasting no opportunity to inveigh against capitalism, against religion, against America, against the exploitation of the third world for the first world's benefit, which he called wage slavery, against the exploitation of blacks by whites, which he said at the top of his voice with an earshot of their black neighbor was still no different from slavery, and reserving a particularly virulent helping of agitated sermon for how Israelis exploited the suffering of the Holocaust to inflict their suffering back upon the Palestinians. In late August 2001, Justin was freshly talked out of the idea that he would be a priest, serving up good works to the underprivileged blacks on the streets of West Baltimore, where the most desperate people were hungriest to hear the word. Justin believed in the almighty might of God, his chosen country, and he believed in everything, everyone, every action, every thought being present for a reason. Charlap mercilessly interrogated those beliefs as though Justin was personally responsible for their not being true. But within 3 weeks of moving into the dorms, both AC and Justin could see the billows of smoke arise from the Pentagon on the 11th of September, all the way from Alexandria. They had a clear view of the smoke from the northwest of their city on the sixth floor dorm room at American University. And when they opened the windows, they could even catch a whiff of the burnt cheese odor of wrecked marble and charred flesh. After the first 6 months, when they realized they could stand each other, they found that their cherished beliefs in their first few weeks of interaction had gone halfway to zigzagging, perpendicular to one another, like the outline of a Greek crucifix. At a community action meeting with the new Black Panthers of the university's Social Justice Network, made AC reluctantly conclude that anti-Zionism was indeed crossed with anti-Semitism, just as his parents always told him with increasing agitation for his approbation. Half a dozen American Che Guevaras, tall, handsome, muscular, each of them like a bronze statue of Achilles, stood perfectly still in a line at the front of the room as a room full of underwashed and over-pheromoned white people sat across from them upon their every word. The whole room exploded in applause when the designated spokesman among the six Panthers said they worried that no president would ever have the courage to pardon Mumia Abu-Jamal. AC hadn't the first idea whom Mumia Abu-Jamal was, but he was sure that the justice system had railroaded the case from beginning to end, and as he sat in the fourth row of seven, was already strategizing on how he would bluff his way through an argument with his parents about it. The designated spokesman among the half-dozen then said that for Mumia's pardon to happen, either the Clintons or the Bushes must rise above the ignominy of their cracker background. The applause after this line was a bit more tepid. The spokesman then said that both the Republicans and Democrats would not act ethically until they rebelled against the shackles of their Zionist masters. Nazi motherfucking fellow travelers! And with these four words, the shouting of which he could not possibly realize how close that got him to getting fucked up for what he said, AC got up and pushed his way through the crowd, making sure to hostilely push down on every person without excusing himself as he got out of his aisle. He never thereafter returned to a social justice meeting and resolved never to protest again, never to be lured in by thy siren song of belonging, never to compromise his anti-totalitarian principles on the altar of anti-imperialism. By May 2002, AC was not only accusing Justin of anti-Semitism for implying that Israel was not justified for its incursions into Gaza as retaliation for suicide bombings. By the fall of 2002, when the Iraq War began to be a possibility, Justin was going to campus protests while Charlap was practically leading the counter-demonstrations in support of it. Charlap insisted up and down that he wasn't a neoconservative, that he was a good liberal who did more for causes more often than Justin Maddox ever did in his fucking life. He started a group on campus called Liberals for the Iraq War. It was him and two other kids on the floor. They wrote op-eds, they spoke on campus radio, they palled around with the young Republicans. They, or rather Charlap, made sure they were seen screaming at the social justice protesters every demonstration. Not All Liberals was the title of an op-ed that earned him infamous campus notoriety when he accused every liberal at the college of being no different than collaborators to Hitler and Stalin. He seemed to be lightly harassed on this most political of all campuses wherever he went, but the more harassed he was, the more admiring acquaintances he seemed to pick up. Soon he was offered a column in the campus newspaper for which the editor told him he had free rein and encouragement to pick off every campus organization one by one with maximum bruising, whatever grotesque malformations of virtue he believes them to possess. And that's exactly what he did, comparing the College Democrats meeting to a meeting in Mao's China of the Revolutionary Guards who whip each other into an ideological frenzy before killing all the men, women, and children in a village. Likening the Residence Hall Association's proposals for raising school spirit to Stalin's May Day parades, where everybody had to act happy in spite of being miserable. Calling the Alpha Phi Omega service fraternity a place for kids to act and behave badly with one another while keeping a squeaky clean veneer, and repeat with details of which members did what with whom. The title of the article was, "Community Service Frat Jobs Blow Their Own Virtue." Justin really didn't like that column. And saying that the stench of Milosevic's henchmen reek on the band Epsilon Iota and Sammy Frats, known by every student for their proclivities toward date rape. After that column was released, Justin warned him that he would risk getting jumped and possibly putting his roommate and neighbors at risk. "Relax," Chollop assured him correctly. "None of them reads the campus paper, and even if they did, they have no idea who Slobodan Milosevic is." He increasingly smoked cigarettes, yellow American spirits, with Christopher Hitchens-like regularity, while his girth seemed to grow to the point that he seemed two neoconservatives rather than one. He always looked older than his age, but nothing aged him as quickly as happiness.
And now we shall hear a debauch tour of... And, well, oh my, oh my. And, this is the moment when we were supposed to have a sermon from Rabbi Shapsa Kichelfarb on this week's Torah portion, but unfortunately it would seem that Rabbi Swamley has hit Rabbi Kichelfarb with Dr. Vitebs 2x4, and Rabbi Kichelfarb is lying unconscious on the floor! Oh, so it's my fault. Of course it's your fault! You just hit one of the most famous rabbis in Baltimore with a wooden board! I didn't like his interpretation. He didn't even get to give the sermon! So? I knew what he would say. So you just hit him over the head with a 2x4? Why not? Dr. Vitebs does it. That's... Oh my God, I think Rabbi Kichelfarb's dead. Oh, so it's my fault. You just killed one of the most eminent rabbis in Baltimore. So he's famous. Sometimes people famous deserve to get hit over the head. Are you a psychopath? You don't have to insult me. What? So I hit a man over the head. Is that a reason to insult a man? Oh, my God. What are we going to do? We're going to wait for him to wake up. He's not going to wake up. He's dead. Oh, so he's dead. So now you're saying it's my fault again. It is your fault. Don't be so mad. We just have to move the body. What do you mean? Okay, I'll move the body. You do the story. You just killed him. It's not my fault. It is your fault. Okay, it's my fault, but you still insulted your father. Oh, my God. You just killed a man and you're still stuck on how I insulted my father? Nobody saw me killed him. I saw it! Nobody saw it. You might have hit him. So you tell the story and I'll get the body out of here. All right.
Justin, on the other hand, seemed to grow into youth itself. His pubescent altar boy years at Loyola High School gave him a clearly noticeable peck of doe flab on his midriff, even through his shirts. But the physical activity of being in a fraternity not only kept pounds off his drinking, but let him actively lose the extraneous baggage adolescence gave him. Ultimate frisbee, intramural basketball, fraternity-wide football competitions, or whatever other stupid excuses for sports frat boys play, left him fit enough to look as though he was realizing his best self, while AC was merely an enormous shadow on the wall. By the time Justin was a senior, a different girlfriend every 3 months became 3 different girls a month. Perhaps it would be uncharitable to call something an addiction that was so joyfully partook of and so willingly indulged by its fellow participants, but there was undeniably something of the compulsion about it. To not only AC, but everyone not sleeping under Justin's rarely washed bedsheets, it was an endless source of comedy, not least because AC made it so, but also because, as AC never failed to point out, Justin was such a dribbling nerd. You can take the boy out of the altar, but you can't take the altar out of the boy. No matter how tattooed or hirsute the girls were that he increasingly now spent time with, Justin himself still looked like a Boy Scout, wearing glasses around his duck's-ass haircut so old-fashioned that the lenses were pure glass on the lower half while being dark along the upper rims. He wore button-down shirts and khakis every day of the year, reserving his 2 khaki shorts for particularly hot days and hoping they wouldn't get dirty too often in July. This was D.C. after all. And most people come to D.C. with some sort of political fascination drawing them there. In Justin's case, the fascination grew directly out of his teenage church work. Knowing that he excelled in his Spanish classes, his parish priest asked a group of committed teens from that church to drive down to Wheaton every week to volunteer at a shelter. Wheaton is a 40% Mexican suburb of D.C. that's only grown poorer as the white population around it grows more opulent. Not only did his Saturdays in Wheaton make Justin a fluent Spanish speaker, they endowed him with a yen to learn more about Latin America, and by the time he got to college, he had a knowledge of Latin American history and politics and culture that struck even A.C. as encyclopedic sometimes. And he was nearly as knowledgeable about science fiction books as A.C. was about literary fiction, able to list details from the worlds in Douglas Adams and Frank Herbert the way A.C. quoted Shakespeare in the Bible. He had weird passions for board games and documentaries that A.C. only encouraged in him. And in the walk-in closet in their master bedroom of the apartment they rented and Justin called on the first day, he kept a collection of action figures from his childhood that he always did his best to hide from his women until A.C. would bring them out in a way meant to humiliate Justin, but which only made him more appealing to the girls who felt like they'd unwittingly discovered a secret. Starting in the summer of 2004, Justin and AC had their own apartment a mile from campus near the Chevy Chase border with rooms which were mercilessly separate from each other. But there was an unfortunately placed air vent on the wall between the rooms that made sound travel much better than before. No matter what night or whom the girl was, AC would be up before them in the morning with a catalog of the noises he'd been woken up with at night. He would catalog the moans, the breaths, the dirty talk, the idle conversation, the encouragement, the apologies after failures. The criteria for a girl being asked back was if the girl found AC's catalog as funny as they both did. But the price of the beta male who worships at the feet of the alpha is envy, an envy that cannot be quenched as long as the beta cannot become the alpha himself. The alpha gets a sidekick who tells him how wonderful he is. The beta gets protection from other alphas and the feeling that he is but one step away from becoming an alpha himself. But the beta cannot become alpha without defeating the alpha. And so both of them should have seen the conflict ahead that arose over Clarissa Johansson, the quarter Jewish proto-hipster and comically sexy Angelino with whom everything was three sizes too large for her frame. Eyes, hair, smile, brain, and every other quality prized by the superficial male. As a cellist from a highly cultured family of musicians from Pasadena with more enthusiasm than ability, she had become a good friend to AC through their years in the college orchestra together. But as a girl of not much self-confidence or emotional reserve, she was perpetually overlooked when it came to anything but high-voltage affairs, which she had with other high-voltage students that were over very quickly.
If you're hearing this, this means that I'm trapped in a studio and I need your help. Rabbi Swambley has just killed Rabbi Gelfarb, and he's burying the body right now. The doors have been locked, there's no internet, and the landlines have been disconnected, and I'm not getting iPhone service. When Rabbi Swambley comes back, I think he's going to kill me too. Please, if you're hearing this, call 911.
Send them to... Oh, Rabbi Swambley, how's it going?
Everything is fine, but I have a surprise for you. Oh, my God.
Hello, Mr. Charlap. It's great to see you.
Holy aren't you going to say hello? Rob Kicklefarb's been hit in the head with a 2x4.
What?
That was my sermon. This week's parsha, or the Torah portion for your Rabbi Chorus listeners, is Toldot, the story of Esau and Jacob. Esav and Yaakov were two brothers who fought since they came out of the womb, but it wasn't until they thought they might have to kill each other that they realized how they loved each other.
Thank you, Rav Kifkofar. That was such a wonderful sermon.
You're very welcome. I'm glad I could be of help.
You need me? I should drive you back to the yeshiva?
No, I've got 7 students who have been waiting at this van the whole time. A big gesund and a good for.
Oh, such a good neshama. We gotta have him on again. Harlap?
I don't know if I can keep going.
What, you didn't like the sermon?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, so can we read one of my stories? All right. All right, just wait a couple of hours. I gotta write them.
What?
They're all in my head. I just gotta write them down. You can wait.
I can wait?
Sure, I wait 10 minutes to read the social media. You can wait 6 hours to write the stories.
Are you out of your mind?
Why are you so mad?
I'm not waiting 6 hours for you to write a story.
Why not? I wait 10 minutes for you to do your story. I schlep all the way to the studio. I even book Reb Kifrofarm for the show.
I am not waiting 6 hours for you to write a f***ing story!
All right, you don't wait. It's no big deal that Harlov doesn't care about the Webb Swamley story.
Get out of my studio!
What? You want me to get out after Reb Kirchhoff gives such a beautiful sermon about people forgiving each other? After I'm a guest at your parents' wedding, at your priest's studio bar mitzvah?
All right. I'm sorry, you can stay.
It's all right, I'd stay.
Yes, it's all right.
Thank you, Harlov. I love you.
Uh-huh.
Come to me. Give me a hug.
Really?
Come on, right. Give me a hug.
I'm not giving you a hug.
After all this, you know I'm not a killer, and I read the social media, and I book Reb Kirchhoff. You don't give me a hug. Come on, right.
All right.
So now you read the first Dunkiner story.
When Cleo was a kid, her family lived in one of the more middle-class homes of the valley. As a bookish girl who demanded a cello at 6 so she could play piano trios with her parents and finish Wuthering Heights at 8 because it was her mother's favorite book, this freckled fire engine redhead was utterly displaced among the richer, blonder proto-valley girls whose parents let them drop their bowels and expose their thighs in the winter of second grade. They were thinner, too. Cleo was a full 100 pounds when she was 6 years old and treated accordingly by her peers, which caused her to burrow ever further into her own world of library books and music and the old studio movies her father took out for her from Blockbuster Video. Her father was a businessman of marginal abilities who ached to become a filmmaker. In high school, he would film his friends in the kind of Western shootouts and battle scenes and car chases that Variety always said Steven Spielberg made as a kid. He even enrolled in USC with the express intention of becoming a film studies major and parlaying the contacts his degree would accord him to a career that followed in the footsteps of such illustrious alumni of the Orr Film School as Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, John Milius, and Walter Murch. But his mother, of course, demanded that he'd study something much more practical and told his father not to help pay for college unless he did. So instead, Steve Johansson promised to become a business major, which he hoped to parlay into a job as a film producer, and his mother hoped would parlay into a job as an accountant or an investment banker. But as a business major, classes in the film school were far too in demand for him to enroll. Instead, he had to enroll in literature classes and hope that he would find some overlap among the film majors. But in the late 1970s, the film brats were as much the big men on the USC campus as NCAA athletes and couldn't be bothered with what some business major had to say about their subject. Over cigarettes after class, the film brats would buzz with invective and ego and occasional enthusiasm for releases that are now classics, and Steve would crowd their circle, barely given enough room to put one foot in while standing sideways, and would try to add the wood of his zealous ardor to their flames, only to find they would inevitably micturate on his fire by talking over him as though he were not there and occasionally flash side-eye looks to one another of irritation and contempt. But it was in a modernist literature class that Steve met Carmen Chavez, the pneumatically petite half-Colombian, half-Filipino girl from West Adams who switched between 2, maybe 3 languages like a native when he picked her up for their first official date on the boardwalk along Santa Monica State Beach on Valentine's Day, 1979. Ray Charles' studio was right down the street from her parents' house, and her dad was Ray's personal electrician, whom over the years would occasionally be invited to smoke grass with Ray himself, and given the frequency with which Ray called the house in the daytime, Carmen always had a lingering suspicion that her mama was occasionally invited to do still more than that with Ray. Carmen didn't live on campus. She was simply the exotic whom guys whispered about whenever she was around. Geez, who is that girl? Because she was female plumage itself. The swarthy girl whose giant sunglasses were sometimes lowered to reveal a set of almond brown eyes whose whites beamed like a reflection of Laguna's sunlight. In spite of the elliptical eyes, everybody would have thought her Latin if she didn't have freckles everywhere and an enormous shock of frizzy auburn hair that went a foot down, 6 inches up, and 18 inches out, or wore Charlie's Angels short shorts beneath her button-down shirts that began well into her voluminous cleft and stopped well above her navel. Shirts on which every conceivable color and shape fought with one another for dominion in an ocular battle so lethal that if what was inside the clothes didn't make men dizzy, what was on the clothes certainly did. When even the film brats tried to strike up a conversation after class, she nodded her head disinterestedly and responded to any question with polite three-word answers centered around the phrase, "No, thank you." It was only by coincidence most fortuitous that they paired off together as study buddies when the TA had students count off to partner with each other. While the study partners were required to meet outside of class for any question about the books, many simply didn't and said they did. But Steve, no small bookworm as himself, would feign ignorance about Kafka and Borges and Proust and ask Carmen to explain them to him over breakfast in the cafeteria, to which she surprisingly always obliged with breathtakingly detailed but quite matter-of-fact explanations the morning before class in a manner to which he never really paid attention. Rather, he would try to interrupt her with comments to make her laugh, and she would truckle politely and then resume her explanation. Attempts to steer the conversation in any direction but the book at hand would come to small talk too generic to be worth developing. After 20 minutes, she would inevitably tell him that she had 10 minutes left and never allowed herself to say a second more than a half hour. Such was the way he allowed her to explain the death of the narrator's grandmother in the Guermantes way, the ambiguities of the relationship between Dewey Dell and Daryl and As I Lay Dying, the contours and finality of hell as rendered in the portrait of the artist as a young man, how the elliptical sentences and syntactical ambiguities of Winesburg, Ohio help us better to process Elizabeth Winthrop's loneliness, that Gregor Samsa was actually a dung beetle, that the parallels between A Man Without Qualities is Arnheim and the German Foreign Secretary Walter Rathenau, how the Aeneid informed the text of the death of Virgil, and how the music described in Dr. Faust does so resemble the music of Arnold Schoenberg. But when it came time near the end of the term to get an explanation from her of Mrs. Dalloway, Steve found that she could not explain it to him. She called him to beg off, saying that she did not have time to do the reading. In a moment that only destiny can prepare, Steve truthfully announced that he had to do a presentation for his high school senior class on Mrs. Dalloway. So he told her that this time he could explain it to her. He was expecting Carmen to say no thank you. But to his surprise, she agreed immediately but asked to meet in an overpriced coffee shop near campus. When he got to the part about Septimus Smith's suicide, he looked up to find delightful tears streaming down that exquisite face, and without warning, she took off her glasses to reveal a set of black eyes. The freckles had disappeared lately, but upon wiping away the tears, the removal of the foundation revealed what looked like half a dozen bruises along her jawline. She then explained her life into his and his alone.
This has been a tale from the Old New Land. What is the Old New Land? Where is the Old New Land? When will the Old Land come to us? The Old New Land is that will to life, that striving to persevere against death and decline to live forever, and the brief moment when the immortality of the temporal self seems possible. It is the conatus that gives our physical selves the intuitive states and emotion that lets us know that there is a spiritual being that lets us experience a world beyond our senses. But it is also the bondage that reminds us that this crude temporary matter is still at a remove from the eternal world and endows the physical self with intuitive suffering, which could only seem like a self-dramatizing affect to a human who lives from more purely physical states. The Old New Land is the human capacity for reason that sees us through our bondage to give ourselves a little less distance from the eternal world and bring our bound selves a little closer to its space without end. Where passion is governed by nature, that is God himself, and for that fleeting moment in time that seems as though it can last forever, we can achieve oneness with nature and the rational tranquility that seems so natural a state and brings us ever closer to eternity itself. But this being the bonded, physical, temporal world, our oneness with nature and the tranquility it brings must eventually separate us and our former closeness to it. We feel much more distant from eternity. We work and we work and we work and we wait and we wait and we wait, but we're always thrown out of the Old New Land. So that's it. That's what? That's the ganze Meise? That's the whole thing. Aha. What's wrong with it? It doesn't have an ending. So I was waiting for an ending. It has an ending. That's an ending? What do you want? I like the first story. It has an ending. I thought you didn't like the first story because you thought I insulted my father.
So you insulted your father. I still like the story. Do you have anything nice to say to me? I like the other story. I just don't like this story. No ending.
Anything else you don't like?
No, Basil.
Okay, what didn't you like?
The other story, it was about Jews. This one's about the Goyim.
It wasn't really.
Yes, it was. It was about the Goyim. It was not about Goyim. Sure it was. You shouldn't be writing about the Goyim.
Why not?
Because you're a Jew.
What? I can't write about anybody but Jews?
Jews are Jews. They're not Goyim.
But you were a Goy.
So?
Until 20 years ago, you were a Lutheran from Duluth, Minnesota.
So what? I'm like that Dolezal woman. I'm trans-religious.
Oh my God, we're never going to get an audience.
Copyright 2016, AS21 Publishing, LLC, all rights reserved.
AS21 Publishing. What do you want your book to be?